and welcome to the Real Fix podcast, your fix of real life stories. I'm Hattie Bishop, I'm a journalist, and I help people share their stories with the national papers and magazines. Each week, I extract my fellow journalists from the newsroom, and we phone up some of the inspirational people who feature in the stories that we publish. First up, we meet the woman from Surrey who fell head over heels with an American convict.
He's not allowed in the UK for at least 10 years.
Right. Myself,
because I've got children from a previous relationship, I obviously can't go out there straight away. Mm. So we spoke about it before we got married, that we knew it would be long distance for quite a while.
And the beautiful moment a husband suffering from dementia proposed to his wife for the second time, forgetting that he was already married to her.
And his face, he was holding me and the penny dropped. I said, "Do you mean you want to marry me?" He said, "Yes." And it was like, "Oh, thank goodness you're finally..." And I said, "Oh, well, that would be lovely." I said, "Oh, good, oh, good." And so I thought, this is odd. But I said, "So am I your new girlfriend then?" And he said, "Yes." Because I knew that he didn't know who I'd been for the last year or so.
But first, a babysitting experience from hell. Meet Rachel from Birmingham. She offered to watch her friend's two children and their Siberian husky, who was locked in the kitchen. When Rachel went down for a drink, she was in for the shock of her life. As she opened the door, the dog lunged at her, viciously mauling her face and body. Before she realised it, she was engaged in a battle for survival. She wanted to tell us about the moment she saw the jaws of death and lived to tell the tale. Joining me in the studio for this chat, my colleagues Harriet Rosegale, Laura Elvin and Olive Loveridge Green.
Well, it was when the little boy decided he wanted to have a drink, and we were really late. We'd been about 11 o'clock, and I was like, "I'll see if I can go into the kitchen." And we had a look, and the dog was sort of sat by the door, and it was like wagging its tail. Not completely wagging, but, you know, sort of like I felt like I was quite safe to go in. I've never been scared of dogs. So I opened the door and the dog came into the front room and it sort of looked at me, but I didn't feel scared or anything. I went into the kitchen and I put the kettle on and ready to make him a hot chocolate, and I thought I'd have a coffee. And I went back into the front room waiting for the kettle to boil, and I sat on the settee and he was on the other one and he was bouncing down on it and he jumped off, and then the noise or whatever, it just bit my face. And I was quite sort of shocked, thinking this actually hasn't happened. I thought, "Oh my God." And I seen the dog and I put my arm out to protect him. But the dog went for me and grabbed my arm and dragged me off the settee and dragged me into the kitchen.
Goodness and then, me. And how long did it all go on for? Like, what were kind of the series of events after that?
It was about 45 minutes that it attacked me, and it was just like, 1 minute it was just making this horrific noise and holding onto my arm, and then other times it was ragging it side to side. That was where the pain was absolutely excruciating, when he ragged it side to side. All I could see was blood coming from my face all over the dog. And the noises that the dog was making was like actually the most scariest bit, because it was the bits I still dream about now.
What kind of noises was it making? How could you describe that?
Like low growling kind of noise.
God, that sounds scary.
And it wasn't like a high pitched or anything. It was just as if it was growling at a bone or growling at, I don't know. I was on like its so-called bed, so it took me to where it wanted to be, and I was trying everything. I kept looking around the kitchen to see if there's anything I could stab it with. I actually didn't believe it was happening at first. I was like, "This can't be happening. This is not real. What the hell?" And I was so scared. The kids ran off, and I was in the kitchen on my own, and the kitchen was like only lit by a little light, and it was like, "Oh my God." And I thought, "I'm going to die here." And then all of a sudden my little boy popped into my head and he was like, "You can't die, mummy, we need you." And I got like this second wind where I was trying to get on the dog to get it, trying to bite the dog. And I just kept thinking, I need a knife. I need to kill this. I need to, how can I get my arm out? And at one stage, it went really quiet and it went right to the end of my arm. And I was watching it and I was thinking, this is it. I can escape. I pulled and the dog just went like three bites, was eating whatever I had in its mouth. But looking around the kitchen, all I could see was like my blood, my fat, my tissue.
Sounds like it was treating you like a chew toy.
It was like I was a chew toy or a bone. I kept thinking, break my arm, bite it off so I can escape. Because I was just so scared that it would go for my throat because it was so quick and so powerful. I'd lost all my energy. The little boy came back into the kitchen and he'd brought the little girl with him who had been asleep through this process. And I was screaming at her, you need to kill this dog, you need to get a knife, you need to do something. And I was screaming, saying, do it. And she was like, I can't. Bearing in mind, she was only like 9 years old, but I didn't know what to do. So I said to her, if you don't get a knife and get this dog off me, kill it or get it off me, I'm going to die here. And do you want to tell my children that I'm dead? Which is a really horrible thing to say, I know. And but she did. She went and she looked around the kitchen and she found something. And I think it was a sandwich knife and she whacked it on its bum back. And the dog released me. She shouted, run, and she'd got the dog outside.
Wow.
So, I know. Half of me wished she'd come down 30 minutes earlier than that, but, you know.
And I mean, what happened next? What was the first thing you did after the dog kind of got off your arm?
I waited by the kitchen door, sort of in the front room, making sure that both kids were out and the dog was out. And then I sat down and I had a cigarette. And I couldn't smoke it. I was shaking, but I'd got a hole in the side of my mouth, which really annoyed me. I was just like, what do I do? But you don't believe this has really happened. Your brain just can't fathom that this has actually happened. This doesn't happen. So I was like, right, I'll ring an ambulance. So I rang an ambulance. And then I sat on the stairs and had another cigarette while I was waiting for the ambulance. And the kids were running around, screaming, crying. I was like, I'm sorry, babies. I'm sorry this has happened. Are you okay? And, you know. So when the ambulance actually came, it couldn't get anywhere near the house. So I had to walk down the driveway to it. And I'd got a long sleeve top on and obviously you couldn't see my arm or anything. And the woman said, so you've been attacked by a dog? And she'd seen my face. And I said, yes. Yeah. She said, is there any other injuries? And I opened my hand and all this fat and tissue and stuff fell out. And she went, oh. And she lifted it up and she went, oh gosh. There was another bloke there and he just started and he went out. And she did apologise. It was quite sort of prominent that he went out. You know, I'm ever so sorry. It's his first night on the job and he's not seen stuff like this.
So he had to leave. He couldn't see it?
No, he had not seen anything like that. So he left and she was apologetic for it.
Did the police arrive at that stage as well then? Because I guess they needed to get this dog under control.
Yeah, there was two police cars and one policeman came in to me and he had a look and he was like, oh, okay. And then I know he went off then to go and have a look at what the dog situation was or whatever, what was going on in the house. He did ask me if the dog was secured. And I said, well, as far as I know, it's out in the back garden. Come back and forth with some information. And then he finally said to me, we've shot it. He said, I've shot it. And I was like, okay. Half of me was like so glad the dog was dead. The other half of me wanted to shoot it myself.
So after going in the ambulance, tell us a bit about your kind of journey to recovery. I understand it was a pretty long journey for you.
It was a long journey. It was 2 months in total. And it started with like debris in my arm, cleaning it up. But then I had infections after infections and had skin graft that just deteriorated. One of the consultants that I was under, he just shook his head while me and my husband were in there and said, I actually don't know what to do. Oh, he said, I'm going to have to confirm with some other colleagues and see what we can come up with, which at this stage was really horrible because I had a massive, great big hole in my arm. Mm. And I was thinking, I don't know what they're doing. And they did say that, you know, there's not many options left and amputation could be one of the options. And I was like, right, okay. And then this doctor consultant come in and, oh my God, he was just amazing. He just made me feel so confident that we were going to get through this and we were going to do this. And he said that he was going to pop my arm into my stomach and he was going to make a skin flap over and I was going to get my arm back. Movement-wise, we were never too sure on, but we were going to not lose the arm.
So this is literally cutting open, you've gone through all this, you're cutting open your stomach to put your arm inside it and then sewing the skin over the top, is that right?
Yes, that's what he did.
Incredible, isn't it?
So I had my arm like that for about 4 weeks because I ended up getting tonsillitis of all things. when he took it out, I had a really big fat arm. It was quite surreal to see, but it was there. And we had to wait until it started to knit together the skin. But a lot of it kept dying. So we had to keep going back into surgery, put the dead bit of the skin away, re-sew it back up, and eventually we got it quite tight now. We lost a lot of skin. And movement-wise, the tendons and the muscles were too badly damaged or taken away. I haven't been able to regain it.
Just backtracking a bit, you know when you've had the arm taken out the stomach, like, what did it feel like? Did you feel, like, numb? Could you feel your arm or, I mean...
I can't feel that bit, no. Like, if I run my finger down the top of it, I get a sensation of pins and needle feeling, if you understand what I mean. But that's it. I mean, I've actually caught my arm on one of my double handles before, you know, how you scrape it. And I didn't feel it until I seen it bleeding. And I was like, oh, okay. So, yeah, there's no sensation in it at all. And there's also no sensation in my cheek that was sewn up. And my belly also has patches of no sensation in it either.
What an incredible escape and an incredibly brave woman. By way of an update since this recording, West Midlands Police have confirmed to us that the case is now closed with no further action being taken. The CPS felt there was insufficient evidence to provide a realistic prospect of conviction. We did approach the dog owner for comment, but they declined. Now, you're listening to the Real Fix podcast with me, Hattie Bishop. Hope you're enjoying the series. If you want to hear more stories like this, click subscribe or follow on your favourite podcast platform. Coming up in a bit, the woman who was left gobsmacked when her husband, who has dementia, suddenly proposed to her again, decades after the first time.
So I just said, okay then, that would be lovely, Will. And he said, when can we do it? So this was a Wednesday. And I said, well, the girls are coming around on Saturday. I said, do you want to do it then? And he said, yes, yes.
But before that, we go to Surrey. And I'd like you to meet Becky. She's 32 and she's a true crime addict. But she didn't go out looking for love. It kind of came her way, all the way from the United States. But he was no ordinary lover. He was locked up in San Diego jail for armed robbery and is never likely to come to the UK. I spoke to Becky and asked her how on earth it all happened.
It's one of those things I had always been interested in, but I sort of left it for a while and thought about it. And then I saw somebody in one of like the groups on Facebook for like crime and stuff who actually, she writes to death row inmates and then she created a group. And that's when I started doing it myself.
Right. So I know that Travis isn't on death row. Were you speaking to people that were initially and then you got in contact with him? How did that happen?
Yeah, so basically my first pen pal is, and someone who I still talk to now, he's on death row. And then I found out after writing to death row for a while that you could actually write to inmates who like got release dates and so on. So that's how I found Travis originally.
Wow. And so what was your first kind of conversation with Travis? Like, who said hi first? Is it you that has to approach the inmate?
Yeah, basically they will put up a like pen pal profile sort of thing, and then you can go through and browse lots of men and women who want somebody to talk to. So with any person you write to, your first letter always seems to be quite short. So you introduce yourself, say who you are, what you like, ask them a few questions, send a picture if you like.
So did you think from one of, you know, Travis's first few responses that there was a connection there, or was that something that came later down the line?
Oh, that came later down the line. We did have things in common because he's an artist, I'm an artist myself. And there was just a little couple of things, like the same sort of music that we liked, and just the way we think about some things was very similar. We found it very easy to like sort of open up to each other as well.
Wow. And did you have any idea that when you first started writing to inmates that you might find a relationship out of it, or, you know, even a husband?
No, definitely not. That was a big surprise, because some of the people who were in the original group, they were like, oh, like, I've got feelings for my pen pal, or we're really close, they call me every day. And I remember sitting there thinking, like, why would you want that, you know, sort of thing. And then roll on like a year or so later, you know, like, we're together. So
yeah. And how do you kind of how do you feel about the crimes that Travis committed? How did he explain that to you, and is that something that you were very worried about at first and now feel more comfortable about?
Well, basically, I only had a rough idea what his crime was originally, and I just knew it was for firearm offences. After a few months, he did open up and tell me what exactly happened, and it was basically like he broke his parole conditions, and he told me what his original crime was. So really, his crimes, they're not anything major, they're not murder, they're not like child or lady, like woman related or anything like that. Yeah. They are literally just, you know, guns should have been where they were, and sadly he got caught with them, not locked away, and then ended it back in.
Yeah, no, I understand. Would it be a different story if maybe he had committed murder?
I do feel that, because obviously that's jumping from one, you know, extreme, but say his crimes are really like petty crimes, if you like.
Would it be something where you feel like you wouldn't have let yourself fall for him if he maybe had killed someone or something like that?
Yeah, I'd have probably imagined that would have been the case, yeah.
And how long is it until Travis comes out of prison?
We're looking at now an extra 18 months. He's got into a couple of fights here and there.
Right.
But the laws and stuff are changing all the time, especially with California, so it could be sooner. It could be the 18 months. It's just really sit back and see what happens and see what we can file for to get his time knocked down.
And what is the plan for when he's out? What do you guys have a fixed plan in place, or is it going to be played by ear?
It'll be played by ear. He's not allowed in the UK for at least 10 years.
Right.
Myself, because I've got children from a previous relationship, I mostly can't go out there straight away. Mm. So we spoke about it before we got married, that we knew it would be long distance for quite a while.
And so I know that you guys haven't actually managed to kind of consummate the marriage yet. Is that something you're looking forward to, or you're nervous about?
I'm looking forward to it, apart from like most reasons, which most people probably can gather. But it's also been nice to actually spend a bit of time together where we're not in such a controlled environment, where we can actually, like, you know, do silly things, even when it comes to like cooking, and, you know, just being able to do stuff without having the guard staring at you for like,
yeah. So do you get your own kind of little area for a day or two? How does it work out there?
Basically, they have little apartments out there, so it's a two-bedroom apartment. It's quite everything you would normally have in like a home, so cooking facilities, TV, etc. And we just basically get a few days left alone.
And how is it, obviously you know, you have to abstain from sex for all this time while you're not seeing your husband. Is that difficult? Do you ever, you know, feel like straying just to get that kind of physical connection, or are you very happy to wait until the right time with your husband?
I'm quite happy to wait. He has, same as a lot of the men, they do try and give you a bit of a hall pass, and they say, you know, if you want to, you can go out.
Right.
But I feel that he respects me more if I didn't, and also I haven't felt the need, and I don't think I could personally do it personally. Mm. I go off and do it, so it just it is what it is.
Yeah, no, I understand. And do you think he'll kind of be a different man when he gets out? Do you expect him to have changed his life around in some way so there'll be no more arrests and no more prison time?
I would hope so. Yeah, I think he has learnt now, this being his second go in prison, that he has wasted a lot of his life in prison.
How long was he in prison for the first time?
I think it was like 5 years, 6 years. So he has done a hefty amount of time inside. He's lost, like, seeing his daughter grow up. Mm. He's lost, you know, friends and stuff. But I also know it's going to be hard for him when he comes out because he has spent so long in prison. He's going to be very, like, institutionalised. So things would be very much a shock for him. So I know it would be a slow learning process for him.
Wow. I think love certainly knows no boundaries in that relationship. A very dedicated woman. Now, if you like that, head to Facebook and search for Real Fix, where you'll find our page, which has more stories just like it, along with extra pictures and videos to go with the stories we feature on this podcast. This will hopefully cheer you up. I'd like you to meet Anne. Anne's a pensioner and has been married to Bill for 12 years. But over recent years, Bill has been suffering from dementia. As the disease has been taking hold, it's brought with it some rather interesting surprises. One day, Bill proposed to Anne, forgetting he had already been married to her for more than a decade. The moment it happened was beautiful. Anne spoke to me, my colleague Neve Butler-Walton, Charlotte Penrith-King and Katie Pearson in the studio because we wanted to know what she said.
There have been one or two things, as most people who've experienced this will say. It doesn't sort of just happen overnight. You'll have noticed odd things maybe once or twice 1 year, and you don't like what happened because it was sort of like, how could that have happened? Then you forget about it because it doesn't happen again. But I would say that I knew something was going wrong in the summer of, how long ago? 9.5 years ago now. There were two things. One, we'd gone on holiday to my sister's, and we've been there lots of times before. And as we drove out of her cul-de-sac, he went to turn the wrong way. And my stomach did a lurch because it was such an odd thing to do because we've been there so many times. And he was very defensive about it because I did jump. I said, what did you do that for? Because the thing is, your fear, it's fear that makes you jumpy because you just want them to have been silly and forgetful.
Yeah.
Because the real fear is actually there's something more going on. And I suspected it that year because I feared it. I don't know why. It was just an instinctive thing. And yet Bill was the brightest, most articulate man ever. The cruelest thing. But anyway, what really made me think something is wrong was we'd always had this lovely routine on the weekends where we'd take it in turns to have tea and toast in bed, and one would make it one morning and the other would do it the next. And it was always the same. We'd have two rounds of toast, each one cut in half. So you'd have four halves. And on this particular morning, Bill brought mine up and I only had two halves. And I just said to him, oh, you've got me on a diet then. And he sort of looked a bit confused. But I thought nothing more of it at that point. And then the next morning, he got up before me so he could do it again, because that was Bill. He thought, I did it wrong yesterday. Well, I'm going to get it right this time. Mm. And he brought up the plate and was delighted to be able to show me that I had four pieces. But it was the same two halves, but each half was cut into two.
Right.
So I had four quarters.
It's still not quite right.
And I didn't say anything because he was so delighted that he was having a chance to get this right, which sounds a bit silly, but that's just how it was. But I knew then something was very wrong. Mm-hmm. And it coincided then with his work colleagues speaking to Bill and saying to him, you know, we can tell that you're making a few mistakes in your emails. And because he and two colleagues ran their own business and they could all share each other's emails, they could see what was going on. And Bill was missing important bits out,
right,
or making spelling mistakes. And so they one of them did have a word with Bill, and Bill mentioned it to me, and I said, maybe you just need to go to the doctor then. And so that was in the September, and 4 months later we had the diagnosis.
When Bill asked you to marry you again, tell us about that. What happened?
It was so out of the blue. And in fact, if you could see Bill now, you'd think, how could he possibly have done this? Because Bill's gone downhill, but then all last year he was going downhill. Hmm. We're lucky to still have him here at home with us, really, to be honest. The fact that he did what he did was nothing short of a miracle. And he'd stopped talking. All last year, everything declined. The skills all declined, and the speech and communication. And he would say a few things, but not an awful lot. And we'd had a normal lunch with my friends, Eva and Paul, at Marks and Sparks. Bill, as normal, hadn't said anything at all. He just sat there, and because in the past Bill was the life and soul of everything. He really was. Everybody wanted to be where Bill was because he was such a wonderful character. So he had become, over the last couple of years, just the very, very quiet person that sits and doesn't say anything. And so that's how it had been, which was just how it is. And then we got back in the car, and I went to our local shop, popped in for a couple of things, left Bill in the car because he was happier left there listening to music. He loves music. And when I got back in the car, suddenly he reached out to me as I got in. And I thought, oh, was I in the car too long? Is he going to, be agitated? And then I realized that's not what he was doing. He was wanting to hug me. And I thought, oh, that's fine. That's unusual. Certainly in the car, but yeah, that's nice. And he started saying to me, I want you. I want you. And I thought, okay. I said, well, tell you what, let's wait till we get home then. And we'll have a hug. And so we get home. And I'm thinking, he'll have forgotten by the time we get home, which is only 10 minutes. But oh. He'll have forgotten. And he couldn't wait to get out of the car. And again, hugging me. And we got in as far as the hall. And I thought, does he mean what I think he means? But I don't think it can be that, really. Because then I said a few things that suggested that, is that what he meant? I said, do you want to go? And he's looking at me all confused, as if to say, what are you talking about? And he said, this is real. It's real. I want you. I want you forever. And he's so, and his face, he was holding me. And the penny dropped. I said, do you mean you want to marry me? He said, yes. And it was like, oh, thank goodness, you're finally. And I said, oh, well, that would be lovely. And I said, oh, good, so good. And I thought, this is odd. But I said, so am I your new girlfriend then? And he said, yes. Because I knew that he didn't know who I'd been for the last year or so.
And he'd forgotten that you were obviously already married when he was proposing again.
He had absolutely no idea that we were already married. Oh. He didn't know me. He knew I was familiar to him. He felt safe with me. And we still go to bed together and eat together. But he absolutely didn't. He hasn't known my name for a long time. Mm, and he always used to call me darling anyway. Mm. But no, all that had gone over the last 12 months. So this was why this was so unexpected and
amazing,
so
yeah.
Amazing. And so I just said, okay, then that would be lovely, Will. And he said, when can we do it? So this was a Wednesday. And I said, well, the girls are coming around on Saturday. I said, do you want to do it then? And he said, yes, yes. So I thought he'd have forgotten the next day, which, of course, was the Thursday. But no, he hadn't in the morning. He said, my eldest son, Colin, came around. And I said, oh, Col, something lovely happened yesterday, because my family are all wonderful, incidentally. And I said, something lovely happened. He said, what was that? And I said, Bill told me he wanted to marry me. And he said, oh, Mom, that's gorgeous. And I said, I think he's probably forgotten now. But Bill was sitting having his breakfast. And I said, Bill, I said, do you remember that yesterday you said you wanted to marry me? He said, yes. Oh. When are we getting married? When are we doing it? And I thought, oh, my goodness. So I said, oh, well, maybe on Saturday then. I didn't know what to put on Bill, so I ended up putting a Hawaiian shirt on him that we got for a just an event, a dress, you know, a fancy dress thing we'd been to recently, but actually it was perfect for the occasion. Mm-hmm. And my unknown to myself, Andrea, my daughter, had got my original wedding music playing as I came out. And they'd got my our first wedding music, the first dance, all ready for when we got, you know, when we'd said our vows. So it was really and truly the most beautiful, unexpected event ever.
It's just so lovely that obviously it's like he's fallen in love with you all over again, the fact that
absolutely
he's asked to marry
and we had what I called the wedding effect, lasted about 6 weeks, because most people thought it would last a few days at the most. But it didn't. It lasted about 6 weeks. And I would say to him, Bill, can you remember I'm your new wife? And he would just hug me and pat me on my back and give me kisses. It was lovely. It was just such a completely unexpected, wonderful miracle.
Oh, what a lovely story. And speaking to me there with my colleagues, Charlotte, Katie and Niamh. If you want to hear more stories like this, click subscribe or follow on your favourite podcast platform. And that's it for this episode of the Real Fix podcast. I hope you've enjoyed the listen. And don't forget, you can read more of our stories on our Real Fix website, real-fix.com. And do follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Real Fix UK. If you've got a story for us, please don't hesitate to get in touch. Bye for now.